And now,
the definition. Definition.
This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to discuss the mass shooting in El Paso, Texas, where an anti-immigrant white supremacist gunman shot dead 20 people, mostly Latinos, in a crowded Walmart. According to the New York Times, white extremist shooters have now killed at least 63 people in the United States over the past 18 months. Last month, FBI Director Christopher Wray told members of the Senate Judiciary Committee that crime driven by racism and white supremacy is on the rise compared to the previous year, and that his agency recorded around 100 arrests for domestic terrorism in the past 9 months.
A majority of the domestic terrorism cases that we've investigated are motivated by some version of what you might call white supremacist violence.
But former FBI agents say there's reluctance within the agency to tackle white nationalist violence, in part due to President Trump's rhetoric. Former FBI supervisor Dave Gomez told The Washington Post, quote, there's some reluctance among agents to bring forth an investigation that targets what the president perceives as his base. It's a no-win situation for the FBI agent or supervisor, he said. Joining us now is Mike German, fellow at Brennan Center for Justice at New York University Law School. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide, How the New FBI Damages Democracy. From 1988 to 2004, Mike German served as an FBI agent specializing in domestic counterterrorism. So we have this weekend of horror from El Paso to Dayton. We don't know exactly the motives of the Dayton shooter at this point. Killed 9 people, mainly African-American. He also killed his sister in that mass slaughter. And we do know, however, what's being attributed a manifesto to the El Paso shooter, who is in custody and apparently talking to the authorities, when he went into one of the most Latino Walmarts in America and just started shooting. Can you respond to what's taken place and talk about the words the president does not want to use, white supremacy, white nationalism, and how that affects investigations in this country?
So President Trump, from the time he was first announcing his candidacy, was using very divisive rhetoric that fit very well into the white nationalist ideology, and identifying the targets that were the them that we needed to protect us from, and those tend to be immigrant communities. And I think that gave white nationalists a bit of comfort that their ideas had permeated into the mainstream. And we saw a lot of these white nationalists become part of the mainstream conversation when mainstream media started interviewing them about the candidacy of Donald Trump. So unfortunately, as we've seen the violence increase from these public rallies and riots, we haven't seen a law enforcement response that would dissuade this kind of violence. So there's this idea that the violence is sanctioned, and that's when it becomes very dangerous, when these white supremacist groups believe that the government actually approves of their conduct and is encouraging them to act. And that's what I think is very dangerous right now. And unfortunately, the federal government has not reacted in a way to dissuade this kind of violence.
You know, like the day before Mueller testified, all the attention on Mueller, Christopher Wray testified before the Senate, and he raised this issue of domestic terrorism, of white supremacy. He's a Trump pick here for head of the FBI. That got very little attention. So what does the government understand that it's not investigating? What reports have been suppressed around the rise of white supremacy, domestic terrorism?
So I appreciated Director Wray's statements that white supremacy presents a persistent threat in the United States. But unfortunately, their policies have actually masked how they use their domestic terrorism resources to make it harder for the Congress to understand how many of those resources are going toward white supremacist violence. Senator Durbin back in 2017 introduced a bill, the Domestic Terrorism Prevention Act, that would have required the FBI to document how many incidents and fatalities were a result of each type of each category of domestic terrorism in the domestic terrorism program, and then how many investigations and prosecutions occurred in each category, which I believe would have shown disproportionate investigations against groups that were not nearly as violent as white supremacists. Instead of producing that data, what the FBI did was change the way they collect the data. So they grouped anarchists with anti-government militias under a category of anti-government. They grouped what had been a white supremacist category with what they had previously called black identity extremists, so that it would be harder to discern how many, whether appropriate resources are going to where there are actually violent acts attributable to these groups. So this is a problem that's longstanding. The Justice Department, as a matter of policy and practice, has deprioritized the investigation of white supremacists. And we talk about a rise in white supremacist violence, but the truth is we don't know whether there's a rise because nobody actually accounts for this violence. The federal government today doesn't know how many white supremacists kill people each year. And they haven't been keeping these records, even as counterterrorism became its number one priority. So what they need to do is change these policies. You know, recently, some former and current Justice Department officials have been arguing that they need new laws, that there aren't sufficient laws. Well, I worked these cases in the 1990s, and nobody suggested we didn't have enough law. In fact, there are plenty of laws, and we wrote a report at the Brennan Center last year, Wrong Priorities on Fighting Terrorism, to show the scope of the laws, not just 52 terrorism laws that apply to domestic terrorism, but five federal hate crime statutes addressing the kind of crimes that white supremacists often commit, organized crime statutes that would prevent the organized groups that act violently and persist because their members can replace one another, and also other conspiracy statutes. So there are plenty of laws. It's a matter of policy. And as a matter of policy, the Justice Department takes hate crimes and defers them to state and local prosecution. And only 12% of police departments across the country even report hate crimes. So we know that the state and locals aren't responding to this appropriately, yet the federal government just defers to them.
Speaking to Fox News, Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick ordered the anti-fascist, anti-racist movement Antifa to stay out of Texas following Saturday's mass shooting at the El Paso Walmart.
You know, I was looking at a story recently. I just saw in the last couple of days where Antifa is posting, you know, they want to come to El Paso and do a 10-day siege. Clear message to Antifa, stay out of El Paso, stay out of Texas, basically. But we don't need them coming in on September 1st. We didn't need them to begin with before this happened. But I would say to Antifa, scratch Texas off your map and don't come in.
So, I mean, here the lieutenant governor of Texas is being asked about the alleged gunman, and he targets Antifa. President Trump has also targeted Antifa. He recently said the anti-fascist movement should be considered a terrorist organization. Mike German, can you respond?
Yeah, it's troubling because this is bubbling up from these far-right white supremacist websites into the mainstream, not just in the media, but now from government officials. So it's quite troubling that there's this distraction, right? Antifa, the anti-fascist, anti-racist groups, there are no fatalities in the United States resulting from these groups for at least a couple of decades. So why we're even talking about that in a counterterrorism context when you have groups that are killing people and we're not responding to those groups in a way that's comprehensive and helps us really understand the problem so we can address it more properly.
In fact, today, I mean, this is all so horrifying. I think El Paso and Dayton were something like the 250th and 251st mass shootings this year. Then going back years, I mean, just today, August 5th is the 7th anniversary of the Oak Creek mass shooting at a Sikh temple in Wisconsin, in which six Sikhs were killed.
Absolutely. And it's troubling because they've had this tacit support from the government. They've had this laxity in law enforcement following up from when they commit public violence that I believe they've been able to recruit in a way that wasn't possible in the 1990s when I worked this this issue. So I'm concerned that typically, if you look through history, you tend to see a lot more political violence around elections. And because they've had this space to recruit and this tacit support from the government, that they can become much more dangerous. And unless the government starts responding very differently very soon, I'm afraid that we're only going to see more of this.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers, if you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your money when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, it's your brother, Ramir Dees. Welcome to this episode of the Class War Battlefield Podcast. You know, actually, I had a couple of programs, episodes in the chamber ready to go, and then the world exploded, and I said to myself, well, maybe I should probably tackle this topic here of domestic terrorism, because, you know, I view it a little bit different than other people, particularly European Americans. Many of them say, oh my God, how do we stop this? I say, where is it going next? Because white domestic terrorism is very, very much a part of this American culture. I recently learned that the FBI does not actually have guidelines for domestic terrorism, which was actually quite a shock to me. Because they were quick to label black identity extremists as a deep concern. And anytime black folks have done anything that suggested that we might be trying to, you know, organize ourselves for the benefit of our community, for the benefit of our ancestry, and to stop the scathing poverty that the Democratic Party has allowed to persist in our communities. You heard what I said. The Democratic Party has allowed poverty to absolutely fester and to ravage through our community and has done nothing. They have contributed nothing to stop this. So, anytime when we do things that challenge that structure, we are set upon very quickly by the authorities as if we are terrorists, as if we are terrorizing the society. So it shocks me that there is no standard for describing and diagnosing domestic terrorism, for God's sake. Why wasn't there a structure created after Oklahoma City? Why wasn't there a structure created after Columbine? Columbine was not the only school shooting of that era. There were many that occurred before that. And there has been many since. The reason I suspect they didn't want to talk about domestic terrorism and try to form a protocol for dealing with it and a model for identifying it and analyzing it is because then they'd have to look into a very dark, dark, dark reality, which is that domestic terrorism is not performed by non-white people. It is a predominantly white instrument. And not only a white instrument, but it has been utilized by corporations and extrajudicial corporate associations to combat various public campaigns. And I think, I'm confident, in fact, that if the FBI, with the DIA, Domestic Intelligence Agency, National Intelligence also, were to sit down and have to create a model for diagnosing domestic terrorism, their concern is not that it's going to be your everyday run-of-the-mill mass shooter that they're going to bind up, because that's going to happen. That's definitely going to happen. But that's not their concern. Their concern is that some of the propagandic tools that are utilized by Fox News, right-wing radio shows, right-wing YouTubers and bloggers, that some of those things might get might be swept up. Some of those things might be swept up in that model. Why do I say that? Ladies and gentlemen, I want to read you something. I decided to go and take a look at what terrorism was in the United States Code. Well, how was it defined? Because, you know, we all know about the Constitution, but what most of us don't know is that there are reams upon reams upon reams of administrative code that has both been compiled and revised and re-revised over the years. And within that code are tons of definitions, which are instrumental in understanding and intergrasping the laws and the legislation that is passed. And if you understand those codes, and particularly the more important definitions from those codes, then you can diagnose what legislation actually means. The reason legislation is often written so in such a overlapping manner where it's kind of hard to grasp is because they know most people aren't going to go back to the source material. Because once you start going back to the source material and you understand what's actually happening, you know, some of the stuff can kind of scare you a little bit because you realize that there are these loopholes and traps that are meant to benefit only a small group of people. So, I Google it. You know, what does the law say about terrorism? And it brought up for me, it brought up for me 18 USC, United States Code 2331, US Code unannotated, blah, 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 blah. Criminal procedure, though. That's the important one. So, unfortunately, they don't have a strict definition for terrorism. Actually, they have something, they have a definition for international terrorism. And this is what it says about international terrorism. One, the term international terrorism means activities that A, involve violent acts or acts dangerous to human life that are a violation of the criminal laws of the United States of, or of any state, or that would be a criminal violation if committed within the jurisdiction of the United States or of any state. B, appear to be intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion, or to affect the conduct of a government by mass destruction, assassination, or kidnapping, and C, I'm going to get back to that one, and C, occur primarily outside the territorial jurisdiction of the United States or transcend national boundaries in terms of the means by which they are accomplished, the persons they appear intended to intimidate or coerce, or the locale in which their perpetrators operate or seek asylum. Two, the term national of the United States has the meaning given such term in sections 101A.22 of the Immigration and Naturalization Act, or Nationality Act, the Immigration and Nationality Act. Three, the term person means any person or entity capable of holding blah, blah, blah. The term act of war means an act occurring in the course of A, declared war, B, armed conflict, whether or not war has been declared between two or more nations, or C, armed conflict between military forces of any region or any origin. And five, the term domestic terrorism means, here we go, activities that A, involve actions dangerous to human life that are a violation of the criminal laws of the United States or of any state, B, appear to be intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion, or to affect the conduct of a government by mass destruction, assassination, or kidnapping, and C, occur primarily within the territory jurisdiction of the United States of America. And I actually had forgotten that that part was there. So that was me. That said, I said I was going to come back to something. Okay. This idea of terrorism, of domestic terrorism, as to intimidate or coerce a civilian population to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion, or to affect the conduct of a government by mass destruction, assassination, or kidnapping. Ladies and gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to think. I want you to think with me. To influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion. Fox News, if I remember correctly, came online in 1997. It did. It came online in 1997. And almost immediately it started attacking the government. And it started raising a ruckus amongst the population, telling the population to let the government know about this and that and that and this. And the government shouldn't be afraid, or you shouldn't be afraid of government. The government should be afraid of you. Okay, that's fine. But they were pushing people to want to intimidate the government to do things that wouldn't necessarily be positive for those people. I'm not saying, and I want to try to, because I'm not trying to say that Fox News is a terrorist organization. That's not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is this notion of intimidation and coercion. They do not specify, they do not define what intimidation is. They do not define what coercion is. They do say, however, to intimidate or coerce a civilian population. In my Funks and Wagnalls dictionary, the word intimidate is defined as to cause to become frightened or to put in fear. Coerce, same dictionary, is defined as to constrain by force, law, authority, or fear, compel, restrain, or repress. Fear. If intimidation is to cause to become frightened, and then coercion moves that cause to become frightened into something that actually restricts the movement of the person, you tell me if right-winged media doesn't fit that first criteria. I don't care if they meant to do it. I don't care if they sought to do it. They do it. And through that constriction and restriction, they then move those people into action to influence the policy of government. Now, this is not a place where I wanted to be. I've been looking at what's happened in right-winged radio and television for a long time, and I've been concerned. But with Donald Trump in office, he's like a personification of the shadows of the dreadful depths of this ideology, which in all reality isn't even real conservatism. And so now people literally are seeing in Trump a manifestation of this sickening, corporate-friendly ideology, which enables them, you know, kind of harkens back to the 1800s and up to the like mid-1900s, where white people, particularly white men, could do whatever they had to do to save their community or protect their community or lay a stake to a claim of land, screwing whoever was on that land before them. This is why I look at where it's going, not how can we stop it. In preparing for the show, I was reminded of the Clive Bundy ranch standoff, and the fact that ultimately he had all criminal charges dropped against him. And how I was talking to somebody about this, and him and I quickly, because he's a black man, him and I quickly said, you know something, let's really compare how this man is being treated on federal land. They barricaded themselves in a federal building. They're threatening police officers. Let's compare that to black folks peacefully protesting in Ferguson and the treatment between the two people. In other words, this society has allowed what is now being called white domestic terrorism to occur. And now, at this juncture, this society is saying, whoa, wait a minute. We don't really want that to happen. Except for the fact that, guess what? Over the past 300 years, you've allowed it to happen. You've encouraged it to happen. You've encouraged, this country has encouraged white men to be deviously destructive. They have encouraged white men to be horrifically violent towards peoples who are often nonviolent with them. But for the sake of building civilization. So when I look at this domestic terrorist stuff, and I see that it's perpetually white men, I said, yeah, that's about right. That's about right. Why? Because that's history. That's history. Because, particularly in this country, white people are coming into a realization that, one, they are not the majority on this planet. They never were. Two, that they won't even be the majority in a generation in this country. And three, that everything, and I believe is not stated enough. Because the spiritual practices of this country lie to us about the spiritual consequences of those who came before us. So we are kind of told that the spiritual consequences of those who came before us have no personal impact on who we are presently. But I don't believe that's true. In the African tradition, that is not true. What is thought and done on your behalf in the past comes through you. And I believe that one of the reasons that white America is in such a state of decline and demoralization and dispossession is because they are now realizing, these European Americans who bought into this concept of whiteness and through that concept of whiteness did a lot of, as we say in the ghetto, dirt. A ton of dirt. They did horrible amounts of dirt. But they did. They did horrific things. Because they were white and they could. Because they were told that their Christian God, their Christian white God, told them, do whatever you want. I'm the God of the Jews. I'm the God of you. Do whatever you want. And now they're facing the realization that, oh, crud. We did all this dirt to all these people. And they are running past us in population strength. I think that's bugging them just a little bit. It's messing with their minds. There is a fear. You know, Miriam Williamson, a lot of people kind of laugh at her because, you know, she's spiritual guru stuff. And during the last debate, she made a statement which people like Stephen Colbert made fun of. She talked about this dark psychic energy that was amassing and that the Democratic Party was not doing things to shatter that dark psychic energy. Now, ladies and gentlemen, most people, especially the political people, didn't pay attention to that. That's just hooba-gooba nonsense. But people such as me, and I suspect some of you too, were listening and heard that and said, oh, wait a minute, what is, oh my, dark psychic energy? because she's not lying. White people, since Barack Obama was elected, have been fearful. It started slowly. I started noticing it in 2009. And it didn't really build until, there's something incredible about this because, and incredible is the wrong word, but wondrous about this. It built slowly through 2012. Occupy Wall Street gave an amazing force to it and allowed it to kind of transfer itself. So it went from kind of this building fear to hope. To hope. And then when Occupy Wall Street was shattered, I remember my brother, who is now working with the ancestors, he has transitioned, he's passed away. Michael Rupert crying, shedding tears on his podcast because he understood what it meant to crush Occupy Wall Street. I didn't. He did. This is a man who was raised on domestic intelligence and very smart and capable when it came to the hardcore aspects of the system, but then he turned very spiritual. That energy caught wind and started growing immensely in 2013. And then as we moved through 2014, it kind of calmed down a bit. It really did, and you could feel it. It just kind of calmed down. Now, I was living in a rural community at the time. You could still feel it there. It was a very conservative area of New York State. Most people don't understand, but upstate New York, outside of like most of the cities, is very conservative. You can feel the fear out there. And you can feel it mounting. After 2014, and Michael Brown and the supposed war on cops, it exploded. The psychic energy, that dark psychic energy exploded. And through 2015, it was just mounting and mounting. And it wasn't just coming from conservative people. It was coming from progressives. It was coming from liberals. And it just blew up in 2016. And that's how we got Donald Trump. There is a time in a nation's life when the diseases that it has perpetuated and built itself on personify. The imbalances which it has utilized to fuel its ambitions and to construct its structures personifies and starts spitting out these cretinous characters which just turn up and churn up the body politic. And this dark psychic energy, which was laughable to people like Stephen Colbert, is real. And you can feel it. And it is creating a situation where mass destruction could be had and could be executed. If corporations were smart, and they're not, they're hollow cancer cells. And I mean that. I know how serious cancer is, and that's what these things are. They're cancer cells. Over the next year, they would shred all of this happy-go-lucky music, which is psychically numbing. And if I can really use this phraseology, because it is apt, they're mind-raping people with this music. And if you don't know that concept, go and you can literally find it. It's actually a word. It's a philosophical studying. I can't even think of the thing. It's a philosophical brand, basically. It's a psychological reality and force. They would stop that, and they would start producing music that accurately describes the situation that is happening presently. Allow people to get political. Allow people to execute social commentary. And I know there's going to be young people who listen, hopefully, to this podcast and say, you know something? I listen to music and they make social statements all the time. They really don't. They really don't. They haven't in about 20, 25 years. They give you some, like, small stuff periodically sprinkled in there. But I'm not talking about small stuff. I'm not talking about the 80s. And even the 80s had a lot of good commentary because, you know, people were still afraid of nuclear annihilation. We're not afraid of that too much today, which concerns me, because that's typically when stuff like that happens. But they would allow this music to come out, this type of political and social movement music, to dominate the airwaves, this poetic music. Why? Because it would start alleviating the pressure. It would start to alleviate the pressure of the society. And it would start clearing some of that mental fog, because people would be able to see how they got to where they're at and why they're there. As long as this mental fog is here, you're creating a dark psychic force, which will then create horrific mutations in the personality complexes of those who are not only within it, but are produced out of it. In other words, the children that are being born today, and this is another African concept, the children that are being born today are going to be seeds of this negativity, of this confusion, of this personality twisting, or this personality debilitation, and they're not going to morally have the same compass as their parents. Some of them will. Many of them won't. Now, I want to bring up a very dark and sinister topic here, because this really does go with the rest of this, and it's one that I kind of fought with myself about speaking of. We live in a molestation-prone society. So many people live with the secret of being molested, being raped as a child, being raped as a teenager, that we cannot even figure out the numbers. But it happens. And this causes a distortion in personality also. But we also live in a society that has granted legality to psychic molestation and to emotional molestation in order to create this force within you to buy and to nurture that hollowness. I was having a discussion with a woman. I will not say her name. And she was raped. And she was raped for quite a... She was technically was molested. She was molested. But she was raped by a family member well into her teenage years, until finally she had the courage to come out and make an accusation against the person. And they then were put away into prison. Unfortunately, not in general population, but that's another story. She is a beautiful person. And I am a person who was also molested as a child. And by somebody who I trusted immensely. And her and I started talking about what occurs when you go through that process of molestation, and the confusion that comes from it, and what happens to you internally. And she made a statement which was, I think, so powerful. And especially when we consider molestation at a psychic level and not a physical level. She talked about the pressure that is built up inside of you every time you are molested. Every time you are made to feel special, as most molesters will tell you, by the other person, by enabling them, their words, to do that. And allowing them then to go forward and do it. And the confusion that comes from that pressure, because on the one hand, the pressure is created from admiration of the other person because they felt that you were special enough to engage in that type of an activity. But then to maintain that special relationship, you have to be very acquiescent to them. And so that conflict creates this incredible pressure because your willfulness wants to disagree with them. But that speciality that you get from that relationship is what you seek, even though you say it is not right. And so from that pressure and that confusing psychological soup that amasses in the mind and particularly in the subconscious, there's this third aspect that arises. And here is the more troubling aspect. And that aspect is the pain, which is often ignored with molestation by the person who is being molested. Here I'm talking both physical and emotional pain. Often psychological goes with it. But there is another, like an inner pain that comes with it. And it's hard to describe. I finally was able to understand it. It's a spiritual pain. And this spiritual pain in metaphysics is attributed to the second chakra. Now, many of you may not know what a chakra is. Marion Williamson would be able to explain to you what a chakra is. But basically, it's an energy center that helps to regulate your body. And the second chakra is around your belly button. And that is where your trustfulness is. That's where your socialization, and not in the aspect of psychological manipulation here, but your connections socially occur. And there is a damage that happens there. And this occurs, this actually, her explanation of this, which I wasn't able to really fully bring it into the metaphysical realm until I started doing a lot deeper work on chakras. But it is that latter aspect, that spiritual pain, that has caused us to get to this point where domestic terrorism will help to almost relieve this pressure. Because one of the things that comes out of molestation constantly is the need to want to hurt the self after, either before or after, the crime is exposed. On the one hand, if the crime is not exposed and the person stops treating you special, and this is very important, I think, with the white community in America presently, because the elite, they're no longer treating them special, but they're still expecting them to be obedient. If the crime is not exposed and the person stops treating you special, you think you did something wrong. And you want to hurt yourself to express the pain, to almost make them feel sorry for you. And also to express the pain to yourself. Thankfully, I never went through that stage, but I know many people who have been molested who have. Moreover, if the crime is finally exposed and the person is then sent away. That can cause rifts within the family, and you can feel guilty. But, moreover, that special feeling doesn't just go away. It's still there. And that creates a different level of darkness internally. So, what I am trying to say here is the state of this society, which has been created by these corporations, molesting us and manipulating us for so long. And I know there's a lot of people who have been molested who would say, you know, please don't use that phrase. It's a powerful phrase and it means this, this, and this. And I'm telling you right now, I understand that. But if you do the research into mind raping, you'd understand that I'm using this term appropriately. What they have created, these social structures, specifically the spiritual, the psycho-spiritual structure that they have created within the society, has set up the tone for these actions. For these actions. And I myself fear what is to come next as we move into the 2020s, because there's about to be an open power struggle in this country. And what has occurred over the last 25 years is corporations have paid a lot of money, and it's gone a lot longer than that, but definitely over the last 25 years, to stoke hatred among the lower class amongst itself. To stoke hatred among the lower class and amongst itself. They have done so in a manner which is destructive to not only the lower classes, but to the second, to what they call the, quote, middle class. And once when this open struggle for power, or this struggle for power becomes visible enough for everybody to see it, because right now, many people are acting as if it's not happening, this country may fragment even more precisely, causing little skirmishes to erupt between factions. And I'm not saying this is going to happen over the next 2 to 3 years. But considering that most economists agree that in the next 5 years, in the next 3 years, there's going to be another major economic downturn. My fear is that over the coming 10 years, you're going to see skirmishes erupt. And from those skirmishes, you are going to see destruction come forward. The exploitation of migrants, of brown and red and off-white, so-called Hispanics and Latinos, is the beginning. Donald Trump recently said about Ilhan Omar that she needs to go back to where she came from. Do you know how many times I've heard European Americans tell black people who have been here for generations to go back to Africa? Do you know how many times I've heard that? As I keep saying to people, this is only the beginning. They're moving up the food chain. They went from Arabs, who could kind of be considered Aryan-esque or Aryan-like. Most Arabs are brown skin or tan skin or off-white skin. And now they've gone to the so-called Hispanic and Latinos. And the reason why I always say so-called Hispanic and Latinos is because those two phrases came into heavy use in the 1970s. In order to separate Hispanics and Latinos from black folks. They went from Arabs to so-called Latinos and Hispanics. And ladies and gentlemen, one or two groups is coming after them. Okay, the first decade of this century was Arabs. The second decade of this century has been about so-called Latinos and Hispanics. Who is next? Black people. Black people. To make this country white again, you have to curb the biggest domestic threat of whiteness, and that's black people. That's where we're going. That's what's coming next. So, you know, I think when it comes to all of this, and, you know, look, I wanted to do a much longer episode. I was going to do a much longer episode. Because I posted a video. And you can actually find it. Go to Class War Battlefield Podcast. I posted a video on my Facebook page about domestic terrorism and about white mental health. And I was going to just rebroadcast that here, but unfortunately the audio isn't that good. And then I was going to talk about it, but, you know, I've gone far enough. And seriously, if you want to see the video, you know, go and you can go to Class War Battlefield Podcast on Facebook. And you can watch the video. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, send them to me. Send them to me. I do actually, before I leave, I wanna talk to you very quickly about something. Because it seems weird to bring up, but it needs to be. With the majority status of European Americans being challenged tremendously. We are seeing a ramping up of voter suppression. I found out that a Republican stronghold southern state, I won't say which one it is, has a majority black population. And yet, black people, and when I say majority, I mean like 60-40 majority. And yet, black people only control like one, maybe I think it was one seat out of that state's representatives to the House of Representatives. 60-40. Black people do not have an overwhelming majority of representatives in the state legislature. They don't control any major departments in that state, but 60-40. And I was thinking, you know, there's been a lot of stories written on the growth of the Asian population, which a lot of the Asians that are being brought over look white. So it makes white people think that they're, you know, still in control of everything. And also how Latinos, Hispanics, so-called, are also fueling the growth. And very little work has been done on the black population. And typically, when that occurs, when the analyses, in whether you're talking government or the non-governmental organs that feed the corporate state, when they ignore something, it's usually publicly when they ignore it, let me say. Publicly when they ignore it. It's usually because that's the crutch. That's what they see as the dominating trend or something uncomforting or something unsettling. My point is this. And I'm going to go on to the... black people are not the third, quote, minority in this country. We're probably number two. And our population is growing far, far quicker than they want to admit. That said, imagine, okay, because right now there is a major backlash because there's just too many Latinos here. But imagine if a group of people who have been said to be, you know, worthless and all this other stuff for centuries, suddenly they're able to control or contribute a third or even a fourth of the representatives of the House of Representatives. The mind of white folks may not be able to handle that. And this is important when we're talking about the demographic shift. Because this is again, it's causing tantrums in the minds of so many white people, particularly white men. And so I was, where I work with several Asian peoples, and most of them come from the a number of them come from the Filipinos. They're kind of all over the place in Asia. But this person was expressing to me that they wish that the Philippines had become a state. And I hadn't really thought about it, but if the Philippines was a state today, the House of Representatives would be roughly a third bigger than it is presently. Because in the Philippines, likely, I don't know if it would actually be a whole state. It might not be a whole state. But its representatives would represent a third of the current House of Representatives. Then I started thinking about that, because the population of the Philippines is roughly 104 million people. If there were, let me back up, apologetic, the representatives of the Philippines would be brown, red, and Asian, yellow. And some of them probably would be Negro Filipino, which would be black. If that was the case, and if a third of, which technically would probably be equivalent to a fourth of House of Representatives, would be comprised of this group of people from the Philippines, to say nothing then when you add into it the black and Hispanics that currently serve. You might be talking about a clean third of the reorganized House of Representatives being colored people. The shock of such a reality would have probably caused what is happening now to occur a lot quicker. Don't forget, the Philippines, I think, was given their independence in 19 or after World War II, we'll say. And if they had become a state instead, that all white House of Representatives at the time, I think there was maybe a couple of black men sprinkled in there, but maybe not, would have suddenly became very colorful overnight. And that, I've always said, that's one of the reasons why the Philippines was given their independence, because the United States couldn't execute a campaign of mass murder, which they had been doing up until the 1930s, of trying to liquidate all of the Filipinos in order to allow white people to then go over there and settle. If they could do that, the Philippines would have been a state. They wouldn't be independent. So, in other words, this has been a long time coming. Questions, comments, concerns, you know, I'd love to hear from you guys. This is your brother, Brian Mayer. I will see you in the next one. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV.
we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments are killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick.